You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader, brought to you by my bookshop, Wellington Square Bookshop, one of the last independent bookshops in the area, and recently voted best bookshop in Philadelphia, of which we're very proud. Today we're lucky enough to have with us Christina Baker Klein. And before we booked her, I didn't realize that, unless things have changed, she'll be appearing at the Philadelphia Free Library, which has the greatest presentations of authors that I know of, on January 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Christina is the author of The Orphan Train, which was published a while ago initially in paperback and has just been climbing and climbing and getting more and more popular. And in our bookstore, as Christmas approaches and the book is on the front table, it's really, really selling well. So when you begin a book and it has at the beginning a family tree or alternating chapters that slide from space and time to character, sometimes you're daunted or afraid, and sometimes you will like one character as opposed to another. Sometimes you're afraid that you'll long for one chapter to end and the one you like to begin. That doesn't happen in this book. It's because, in my opinion, this book is, in so many ways, a journey through life. One journey almost complete, the other well on its way. The book's central theme is the concept of what we carry with us when we make those journeys, and what we leave behind either out of necessity or because someone refuses to allow it to be taken, or tries to refuse it. The reason why you're pleased with the way the book is written is because, like a quilt, the characters, the places, the portents of the past and the future are woven together in many different ways. And it's this weaving and the loom that creates the tapestry, to mix metaphors, that gives the reader not only the satisfaction of a wholeness, but the challenge of ending a book that is, in many ways, just beginning. So welcome, Christina, and thank you so much for joining us today.
What a beautiful description. Thank you.
You're welcome. As you have done in so many interviews, and we just discussed this a little bit, but it's really necessary because of the complexity of your story. Why don't you just tell our listeners about the novel, the research behind it, and why you chose to make it part of your life's work?
Sure. Well, so Orphan Train is the story of a 91-year-old woman with a hidden past as an orphan train rider, and I'll explain more about that in a second, and a 17-year-old girl who's a troubled foster kid who lives with a family where she doesn't feel welcome, and she steals a book from the library and has to do community service. And her community service is cleaning out the attic of this old woman, which she thinks is going to be boring and stupid. And she gets there, and this woman is wealthy and a little strange and doesn't seem to have anything in common with her. But as the girl, Molly, starts to unpack these boxes, she realizes that, in fact, their stories are much more similar than she ever would have imagined. And as she gets the old woman to tell her story, the two people connect. And so that's the story. That's the story. But the way I came up with it actually wasn't just a matter of kind of finding a story and doing research on it. About a decade ago, I was visiting my in-laws in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, and there was a snowstorm, and I have three little boys. I had three little boys at the time, and my mother-in-law pulled out a book that was a celebration of her hometown of Jamestown, North Dakota. It was filled with newspaper articles. She'd never really looked through it, and as they were going through it, she and my children, Hayden, my oldest in particular, they stumbled on a story about the orphan trains coming to Jamestown. Carol had grown up there, my mother-in-law, her whole life, and had never heard about the orphan trains, which is this kind of huge movement, the largest migration of children in our nation's history, 250,000 children sent on trains from the East Coast, mostly New York, to the Midwest over 75 years, ending in 1929. I'd never heard of it. My husband was a history major at Yale. You'd think maybe he would have heard about it in at least his history books, but no, he hadn't either. And the most amazing thing is that her father was featured in this article. So that was what set me on this journey. I was really curious about what happened, about how it unfolded and what the true story was. And in the course of my research, I discovered that her father hadn't been on an official orphan train. His train. He and his siblings were on a train from Missouri. But the truth is, at this time, there were children sent all over the country, in fact, all over the world, on trains to places that they had no idea about and into families where they didn't know anyone. So it was quite a volatile time for children.
Talk about a little bit about, because I have a moral question about it, about the Children's Aid Society and how they started the whole process of this journey.
Well, in 1854, a Methodist minister named Charles Loring Brace, who was a reformer, lived in New York City, started the Children's Aid Society, which was the first big orphanage. And he looked around and he saw that there were 30,000 children living and dying on the streets of New York. It was what we think of as Dickensian London is really what New York was like at that time, the mid-19th century. Children were dying of starvation, of disease. They were going to prison, becoming prostitutes, joining gangs, getting run over, dying of starvation. It was a terrible time to be a child. There was almost no There was almost no social mobility. There was no welfare. There was no foster care. There were no child welfare laws, no child labor laws. Children were property, and poor children were labor. So Brace came up with this kind of fresh air fund idea to send children on trains to the place where farmers were routinely being given big tracts of land. Even bonanza farms were happening, which have thousands of acres. And the point has been made several times that some of these orphan train riders actually replaced slaves. But Brace was a reformer, and his idea was philanthropic. He wanted to save these children from a life of destitution and poverty, and this idea made sense to him and sort of to society at the time, although it sounds ridiculously barbaric to us. The idea that these children would line up by height and be plucked out of the lineup randomly by strangers is hard to imagine with our modern sensibilities. But given the fact that there was no government protection for the poor and that philanthropy didn't really exist and wealthy people were not giving money to the poor either, it was a solution to a problem that was huge in society.
Yeah, and the moral dilemma I have is this is a good man, a Christian man, someone who wanted to affect change in the best way possible, but in the process, and you know, you talk about in the book, it's very clear how stern these people were in instructing the children before they got on the train and when they got off to be hopefully chosen. Mm-hmm. But what happened was, yes, they got out of a place where they probably never would have gotten out of, but sometimes they went into a place that was either just as bad or worse. So, but on the whole, I would have to say I believe it was a good thing to do. What would you think?
Well, I always say that the people who took in the orphan train riders were as varied as human nature. It was a total crapshoot. There was no screening process. At the same time, we have to remember that it was a labor program. So in addition to even the kindest people, unless they were taking in babies with the express purpose of adopting them, they were taking in people who were going to work for them. So there were problems with this idea, and it was very hard to be an orphan train rider. And the philosophy at the time was that it was best to cut these children off completely from their past. They weren't allowed to even talk about their families. They said, your life begins now. Your parents are not your parents. You should never speak about them again. Siblings were separated because they thought it was an easier task for the children to forget if they weren't reminded by a sibling. So, yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I do think that it probably saved quite a few lives, but I also think it was the perhaps best alternative of a bad time in history for children.
Well, as you say, families, you know, the saying, all families are dysfunctional, they're just dysfunctional in different ways. Mm-hmm. And your characters are like that. Oh, there was one other thing. I don't want to lose my train of thought, but one of the authors who signed at our store said, whatever you do, if a book requires a great deal of research, don't have someone say to you, your research is showing. I guess, which mm-hmm. is like a guy coming out of the men's room with his zipper undone.
Yeah.
And that was what was really cool. I mean, I knew you did a tremendous amount of research, And you talk about why it was a novel, but your research never shows, which I think is really cool because all of the research is in there. It just isn't laid out like, look how much research I did to do this. And I think that's really important to make the book.
Yeah, I mean, I really didn't want to write a novel that felt like that. You know, I get sent a lot of novels to blurb these days, and a lot of them have historical element, and quite a few of them I just find are stuffed with research in a way that feels like regurgitation. I worked really hard to cut back. I just kept paring back. As you probably have noticed, the prose is fairly spare, and I did that on purpose. I wanted it to be unsentimental, and I wanted it to be her story, and I cut any extra detail that felt like it wasn't something that was organic to the moment. So I did do a lot of research, but quite a bit of it I had to leave on the cutting room floor because I didn't want to stuff it, as you say, with that kind of like, here's all the work I did. Look at everything that I did.
Well, it's funny because you say unsentimental, and it really, really is unsentimental. And there's an area that you may swear not to discuss, which is really unsentimental and almost like I'm going, no, well, never mind. But all your characters are, for the most part, are an amalgam of good and bad, except for people like Dina, who is a royal pain in the butt.
Well, it's funny because Dina, we can talk about Dina. I'll get back to your other thing in a moment, but Dina opens the book, essentially, and she's a foster parent who has little patience for Molly. But what I always say to people is I actually do have sympathy for Dina because I had teenagers while I was writing this book. That's partly why I wrote about a 17-year-old girl. I had a 17-year-old and a 16-year-old boy living in my house and lots of girls trooping in and out. And Molly was very protected, very suspicious, very unfriendly. She had been mistreated. She was goth. She looked a little forbidding, and she wasn't giving an inch. And I think to be a foster parent of a kid like that can be tough.
True.
So Dina had, Dina was sort of trying to relate to Molly, but she didn't find common ground. And every time, Dina was sort of a simple person from a simple part of the world, that, she didn't want a vegan goth, dictating that she couldn't serve Hamburger Helper if she wanted to, at night, and kind of setting the tone.
Yeah, but you wrote it, and you didn't have to stick in there that she had a job that she complained about, but she really didn't do anything all day. That's what did it. You could have taken that part out, and I would have had sympathy towards her.
Don't we know that many people who do that? I probably do that, too.
So do I. I'm doing it right now.
I'm doing it, too.
Well, and then,
but just to go back, can I just quickly, before forget, to go back to what you said about the part that we're not really talking about, I just want to say one thing that I noticed about Orphan Train Riders, and to go back to the unsentimental tone, even when some sort of cataclysmic things happen. I was privileged to write this book at a time when I could talk to living train riders. And when I started the book 4 years ago, there were about 150 living train riders. Now there are fewer than 10.
Wow.
And they're all between about 95 and 105. So I interviewed 7, and I read over 300 first-person stories. And what I found is that generally they're fairly unsentimental because they went through so much. And I wanted to create a character in Vivian who ultimately, she succeeded in business. She became a successful woman in her own right, in part because she sort of pushed down her feelings about the stuff that had happened to her and just barreled through. It was the way she succeeded. One train rider said to me, "We are survivors. To get on those trains, to make it all the way, to get pushed around and deal with the rough stuff we had to deal with, the people who came through and persevered and are now talking to you about it are the ones who have that kind of nitty-gritty strength of character." And so I wanted to show that in her, and also to say, that's not always the healthiest thing psychologically to push things down and barrel ahead. But it does, however, sometimes make you succeed in the sphere of economics and life in that way.
Well, Molly has it bad in a lot of ways, but if you end up having to live with Mr. Grote and and Mrs. Burns.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you couldn't really have it worse than that. Except, like I said, even with the amalgam thing, Mr. Grote, there is a part of him that you can emphasize with, don't you think?
Yeah, he was kind to her. He was the first person who really talked to her like a person. He taught her things. His wife was checked out, and his kids were little, and she was sort of his friend in the family, which made his betrayal even more extreme for her. And that's not an uncommon situation either. When a child is unprotected and there's no one looking out, that kind of situation can happen. So, and I'd heard about this happening, and I know people it's happened too. So I wrote about all of these things from experience in all different ways. I mean, when you write a novel, you kind of pull from everything. So, and many times it wasn't until I'd written even a draft of the book before I could connect it back to real things or to bits and pieces. You know, you're like a magpie when you're writing a novel, so you're always pulling things in. And sometimes I would even write on the train back from New York City, and I would, a scrap of conversation would come into the book. So it's funny to pull it apart and see where they all came from.
Yeah, it's almost impossible not to do, and sometimes they dovetail so nicely with your story that you'd be a fool not to include them.
Yeah, exactly. And you're attuned, when you're working on a book, you're attuned to the things that work in your story, which I find really fascinating, too. I'm working on a novel, another novel now, and I am paying attention to different things.
You know,
one
thing that, again, this is an aside, when I started reading it, I asked myself, am I reading a woman's book? Do you ever get, I mean, you know what I mean? It's like...
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have four other novels, and my last novel in particular, which is called Bird in Hand, is really not at all aimed, geared toward women. There are four characters, two of whom are men. They have their own perspectives in the book. But I think that women are often sort of pigeonholed in that way, and
yeah.
I did write a novel, The Way Life Should Be, with this kind of a romantic comedy, kind of geared toward women. I never thought that Orphan Train was, although there are two female protagonists in it. And what I found, I mean, there are 2 million copies in print, so I think quite a few of those are men, and I get a lot of responses from men. And also, I think because it has this historical element, there are a lot of men who read history. They might not have been the first wave of readers, you know, the first 30,000 people might not have included many men, but I think now that a lot of men are reading it, and actually I was just at the Philadelphia Museum for the Borrower's Ball, the Philadelphia Library, I mean,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of men there came up to me who had read it or were reading it. Sometimes it's because a woman puts it in her husband or boyfriend's hands, but yeah, I think and believe it's a book for men and women. After all, it's this big part of history that happened to both genders in our country.
I agree completely. It's just that publishers are smart, and I don't know whether you vetted the cover, or this is the cover you chose, or whether mm-hmm. How did it come about, the cover? Which is a great cover.
There are about 20 different covers, and I actually knew that this was the cover the minute we saw it. I mean, I kept turning down covers, and it would get so that my editor would email me, and I'd see there was an attachment, and I would just think, oh, no, I don't want to say no again. but we knew with this cover. I mean, and I'm so glad that we didn't settle on an earlier cover. But the reason there were some less gendered covers, this cover is of a little girl, but I felt that it conveyed so much about the book and the depth of the book, and it didn't feel like a chick lit cover either. The other thing is, there was an interesting study the other day, I think the Pew Foundation or somewhere, that it was looking at who buys books by men and who buys books by women, and that, you know, no matter what, apparently, men tend to buy books by men and women tend to buy books by women in great numbers. So you can't really help that. Even Alice Munro and, Marilynne Robinson and writers who are really not gendered in their covers or anything else tend to be bought by more by women than by men.
Well, having owned this bookstore for as long as I have, you know, the adage of you can't judge a book by its cover, pretty much everybody who comes into my bookstore that doesn't know what they're looking for does. I mean, that's what they do, and it's just very clear. So
remember that wonderful, and anyone can Google it, there's, if you Google book covers, gender, there's this wonderful series of book covers of books by women and books by men that are bestsellers, and then they imagine them with opposite gendered cover, and it's really interesting. Like The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides, for example, if it had been written by a woman, it would look like Her Husband's Secret by Leanne Moriarty, you know? It's fascinating.
Well, I will say this. In the cover, Neve looks, at least in my mind's eye, well, you can talk about this because you have in other interviews, too. I mean, Neve had a lot of things working against her. She had red hair. She was from Ireland. She was Catholic. She was too tall. She was too old.
She was a girl.
Yeah, she was a girl. So, but the girl on the cover looks like this sweetheart little girl that's, you know, I would love to adopt.
Well, you know, she looked about 9 to me. And what I love, so I'll tell you the things I love about the cover. I love that the cover, well, first of all, when we decided to publish originally as a paperback, it was because all these national book clubs wanted to use it right away, and it was a lot of copies. The Target Book Club, something called She Reads, there was a whole Goodreads thing. And book clubs tend to prefer, as you may know, this
yes,
is a book club
definitely.
Store owner, book clubs tend to prefer paperbacks. So I had never published in paperback as an original, and it was a big deal. I did not want to do it at first. I wasn't sure, but it was such a great number of copies we were talking about that were already sold the minute the book published. So we took a chance on it, but in doing so, I managed to bargain for getting deckle-edged pages, which means they're kind of uneven, like an old-fashioned book, and French flaps, which means you have these flaps that you can, like a hardcover, kind of. And also having different textures on the cover, so there was a metallic texture, a shiny, and a matte. There were all these different things, so they had to spend a lot of money on it. And what I love about the cover is that you open it, you open the book, and you're opening the door of the train. You're stepping into the train. And also that the girl on the cover is reflecting. She's obviously deep in thought, but there's also the outside is reflected in the window, and it feels like a memory. It feels like the past. It feels like she's moving. She has momentum, but there's this sort of otherworldly quality to it. I think it just works really well, and I really like that about it.
Yeah, and I noticed pretty much all of those things, and especially when you do something with the cover, like the metallic, like the foil, people do, what do? They run their hand over it.
That's they do, yes. So many people at events tell me that they come up holding the cover and say, I love the cover of this book, feeling of it.
Here's one. We were talking before about the top 10 questions you're asked about the book. Here's one that you're not asked about, I don't think. Would be why did you put lice in the book?
Oh my gosh. Okay, so I have 3 boys.
I know. I knew that was what you were going to say. Go ahead.
Well, if you know the answer.
Well, that's I want. I guessed it. That's all.
So I have 3 boys, and my oldest 2 boys never had lice. They both have red hair, by the way. And my youngest boy, and I was kind of a little bit, you know, snobby about it, like, well, of course my children do not get lice. That just doesn't happen in my household. All these other families have to deal with lice. So then my child, who was at the time, I don't know, 8 or something, or no, he was older than that, 9, I don't know, he came home with lice, of course, and not only that, it was horrible and just awful to deal with, but he came home with it again, like 2 months later. He had it again, and we had to do the whole thing, wash everything. It was such a nightmare. And as I was working on the book, I thought, oh my God, I think this is bad. What would it be like to have lice if you have no running water and you have nothing else and you have to get rid of it? And I had been reading stories of train riders. Lice was really common, really common. And so I just put the 2 things together. I had all this experience, and I had a visceral response to it that I thought I should really take advantage of this.
Yeah, they had to close my daughter's school because they had, like, sofas in the school, which you don't usually have.
Yes.
But see, now you have the tiny, tiny little combs, and which help out a lot, and that horrible shampoo and all that, but those little combs make a big difference.
They make a huge difference. I still have the kit just in case. it ever comes back. But that was truly one of the worst experiences. I mean, I've never dealt with bed bugs, but I have friends in New York who have had to deal with that. And apparently, apparently that's just hellish. So I wanted to convey the horror that we feel even today, but pointing out how much more agonizing it was back then.
But it wasn't one of the top 10 questions.
That was not one of the top 10 questions.
Good.
But it's a good one. I like it.
Thank you. The other thing about the amalgam of goodness and, badness, is that, Miss Larson was, so much like Miss Honey in Matilda.
Oh, yeah.
And I loved her so much, and Mrs. Murphy, too. But it was like, please, 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 just let her just stay there. But then it wouldn't be a book. But, I mean, but they were so nice, and it was such a journey for her to get there to school, to the schoolhouse. And it was so nice that she finally had, although the Nielsens, I mean, that was a nice area of the book because it was when she finally got what she had deserved for so long.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I wanted to show, and I don't think it's giving anything away to say this, is that for so many train riders, when and if they finally ended up with people who took care of them and actually cared for them, even so, many of them never quite had a family. Never quite. You know, the Nielsens were caring people and treated her with respect, and she was fed and had a roof over her head and had sort of enough to eat and all that. But they didn't want to be called mother and father, and they were, they were a little bit distant in some ways. And I kept hearing that over and over again in these train rider stories, that many of them never quite felt like they belonged. And I wanted to show that. But I also, I know with a book like this, which is can be hard to read sometimes. I mean, there were parts of it that were not, where she was going through a lot of stuff. And there were good people, as I say, and I wanted to show that as well. I wanted to show that a teacher can have such a profound effect by spotting, by being kind and spotting trouble when she sees it.
Not only that, but again, like in Matilda, knowing that the person is so smart and has such potential, if only she had the time and the money and the loving, house.
Yeah, exactly. It's recognizing that when most people can't see it.
Yeah, especially, and again, not giving anything away, especially since she, Miss Larson, was tied to this boarding house where she couldn't really do what she did, and she just lucked out because Miss Murphy was such a cool lady.
Well, and also because she's Catholic and Irish,
Oh, yeah, right, sure.
I mean,
yeah.
So, another thing that I was struck by reading the stories and of train riders, real stories, and talking to them, is that oftentimes, and this is just human nature, the people who help you are the people who relate to you in some way. And so it wasn't really calculated that I made Mrs. Murphy that person who, connected, took pity on and was kind to Dorothy because she had something in common with her, but that's only human nature.
What's really funny about the book, like that incident, and it's hard to talk about with you, I am, but it's hard to talk about the book because there's so many different things that happen, and we haven't even gotten really to Molly yet. And I know it's in a lot of your interviews, everyone's so excited about the orphan train that they forget to talk about Molly.
They do.
I know. They just ignore her as if she doesn't exist.
It's true.
But the one thing is this book has a love story, and without giving anything away, the love story develops. You develop it in such a short period of time and so few pages, but it's so poignant and so true, and you're not even sure why is this love? How is this love? What made this love?
Right. I think that I was...
Because it truly is. It truly is love.
It really is love, and I'm trying to figure out how to say this without giving it away. It is love, and I think that because the groundwork had been laid earlier for the story, the reader was there was a shorthand for it that the reader understood that there was this depth of connection.
Yeah, and I had no problem with propriety or impropriety relating to the latter part of the relationship. That was well put without spoiling it, right?
That's good. That's really good.
No, because some people would, you know? I mean,
yeah.
And that's what she was afraid of when she went out that night.
That's right.
But, so, I guess, you know, you do the epigraph in which you talk about the Indians that had a portage.
Yep.
They had to carry their canoes, and they could only take what they could take with them. And
yep.
So this book is about carrying things, more for Vivian than Molly, because Molly, as I said, is beginning her life.
Mm-hmm, right.
But to get personal, because I think other people have with you. I mean, mm-hmm. but even if they hadn't, I would still. What do you carry? What do I carry? Not that anyone cares, but what do you carry?
then we have to ask you what you carry.
Okay.
And what do you leave behind, right?
Yes.
So I'll tell you one thing that's very personal, I suppose, but is very much a part of this book. My mother was a professor in Maine. She, you know, while we were growing up, she had a master's degree in teaching, but then when she was 45, she went back and got a PhD. She eventually became a full professor, and then she ran for office and became a state legislator in Maine. She got very involved in Indian rights, and she and the only Penobscot Indian Wabanaki elder who had ever been in the state legislature, Donna Loring in Maine, the two of them put together the first legislation in the nation to make studying local Indian tribes compulsory in the public schools in Maine. So there are now 7 states that have this kind of legislation, but my mother was really involved in that. She was also really involved in something called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which exists in a number of states now as well. Indian children, Native Americans, were taken out of foster care, taken out of their homes and put in foster care with non-Native families. This is a long explanation, but my mother was really passionate about all of that while I was writing the book, and that's partly where, of course, my own interest in this whole subject came. I grew up in Bangor, which is 10 miles from Indian Island that I describe in the book, and I went to school with some Native Americans as well, but it was really my mother's research that guided me, and we worked together on that. And then she died before my novel came out. Unexpectedly, she had a stroke at 73 and died 3 months later. It was awful. And it was 4 months before the novel came out. So when you ask, what do I bring with me? I bring her with me through all of this. And, you know, she was able to read at least the full novel before she died. And I'm really grateful for that. I also dedicate the book to her and to my mother-in-law, who father, as you know, was an orphan. But that's a really important part of my legacy and my history, and it's in the book. And so that, I would say, is the most important thing.
And you channel some of that through Molly.
Yeah, exactly. I do. I think Molly's sort of anger and her own growing education mirrored my mother's experience as she uncovered and discovered what it really felt like to be, you know, an Indian in Maine who had felt shunted off and had been mistreated for centuries, essentially, you know. And that political activism is, again, I'm not overt, and it's, you know, as with the history, I was really careful to kind of keep a strident tone out of the book, but there is this current of activism in the novel.
Well, it's good because you bring it from her schooling, which is good because it seems natural.
Yeah.
When she's talking about it.
And that's the schooling that my mother helped make possible.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. So,
but it's we were talking about this. We did one show with my manager of the bookstore, and we were talking about the best books of 2014. But we were also talking about the atmosphere of my bookstore, which hopefully someday you can see.
I can't wait. I'm going to come when I come to Philly, yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. Maybe we can arrange a signing because I can.
Yeah, let's do that. I'd love to do that.
Okay. Oh, that would be great because our book club would. And then we can make it the book club pick. Okay.
Yeah,
cool.
Let's do that. And I will come to the book club.
Okay. Oh, wow. That'd be great.
Yeah.
I have to tell, I can remember everything about this. Okay, I'm writing this down.
But I'm there for a week, so we might as well in March.
Okay. Are you going to be in, are you going to really still be there in January, or did I get it wrong?
Yeah, no, I'm going to be there in January for the kickoff. And then there's an actual week-long series of events. So I'll be in downtown Philadelphia for a whole week, and I would love to do, maybe that could be something that we could do in March, if that works for you.
It works perfect. I'll send down a limo to get you.
Ooh, that sounds great.
It's what I was going to say before we did this was that what's really nice, and the way that Molly begins to pick up the canon, books that you don't expect young girls to be reading nowadays.
Yeah.
That's what I love. One of the things I love about the bookstore is going back and seeing a kid, sometimes a girl with her legs tucked under, just like, oh, just like.
It's so much fun, I know.
I know. I was thinking of Dutchie, and I was thinking how she tucks her legs under in that one scene.
Yes.
That's the posture that I see young girls reading Moby Dick or Bronte. And I look at it and I say, you know, it doesn't make any difference whether I ever make a penny in this bookstore. All that I need out of life is to see that, you know?
It's so exciting. It's really exciting to see that. I've done a lot of community reads, and I did one where they had a book club that was reading all the books that are mentioned in Orphan Train, which was really fun.
And that's another thing I like, is like when you take a book, and there's a new book, I've forgotten the name of it, it's about a guy who owns a bookstore, and he gives life lessons to his granddaughter, and all the life lessons are tied back to a specific book in his library.
Oh, that's great.
And I love that kind of thing. And you kind of did that.
Yeah. Anne of Green Gables and Jane Eyre, all these, there are so many orphans in literature, and I wanted to kind of light a light on that idea.
Yeah, like Pip.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you ever, here's another one no one's asked you, or it's not top 10. Did you ever watch the movie The Orphan Train from 1979?
Of course. Well, there have been a couple, but the Jill Eikenberry and Michael Tucker movie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just
looked at it. Yeah, uh-huh. It's not very good. But yes, I did watch it. I've kind of seen everything. I mean, there was one episode of Little House on the Prairie about that featured an orphan train rider. There's an American Girl doll who has an orphan train rider friend. There are all these like little tiny mentions all over the place.
It's
in
so funny.
National ways. Yeah. But
that question yet, still wasn't in the top 10, right?
No, that was not in the top 10.
Okay, I'm just checking these off. The other thing that's really cool and ties the book together, and it reminds me of me, is when you clean an attic and you don't clean it at all, you just I might need look at all these albums I've had since 1968. I can't throw them out, you know?
It's like you kind of neaten the stack a little bit.
Yeah, that's about all you can do. Or you can do what Molly did a good job, because she inventoried.
Right.
And she cleaned up and probably dusted, and everything was stacked better. But it caused her a little bit of problem because, you know, Jack?
Yeah, Jack's mother.
Yeah, her mother, you know, and everyone thought she was just kind of like conning the old lady, because that's what everyone thought she was.
Yeah, exactly, which of course is what happens when you're disenfranchised. People are likely not to believe you and to think you're taking advantage.
Which happened to Vivian, too. I mean, that was the other cool thing, is that there are so many parallels between their lives, which is obvious. But it works really well. And that's another reason why you can switch from one chapter to the other without thinking that you're missing something.
Yeah, you know, I did a presentation to a room full of 60 social workers from Newark, which, by the way, is like ground zero of social work as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
But it was fascinating. They read the book and they were talking about these parallels. And one of them said, you know, the problem of disenfranchised and unwanted children will never be fully solved, no matter how many social programs there are, because the emotions the children feel today are still the same. They're exactly the same feelings. And she said, you know, we don't send children on trains anymore across the country, but we do send them in cars 3 hours across state to places they've never heard of, people they've never met, and expect them to assimilate and to kind of just become part of these families. And she said it's not really that different on a fundamental feeling level.
And that's where the moral dilemma comes in, because, and I just was listening to Sarah Silverman, the comedian, talking, and she was talking about, and she used the word retarded, and she used it saying, I'm not saying retard, I'm using the word retarded because I feel like that's a good description of the situation of some children. And then what she said was, you know, and she, this is the word I can't use, I don't give a blank about people's advocates. I'm not interested in advocacy. I'm interested in who they are, what they are. The advocates can whatever. And that's where the moral dilemma comes up with the orphan train. You have an advocate who very strongly wants something to happen.
Yeah.
But then the concept, you know, it's like having an event, this banquet for AIDS. And rather than people just giving money, they have a banquet where they can wear great clothes, they have an after party, they have wonderful food.
Right.
And that bothers me a lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's the question is, for fundraisers, how do you get people to give money? A lot of times people won't give money until they're wearing, you know, unless they have something fun to do, something festive to do, and then maybe have a few drinks and do a silent auction, you know what I mean?
I went shopping last night at American Eagle because my 17-year-old loves American Eagle, and the woman behind the counter, the girl who helped me, was so nice, and she was so funny, and she was talking about she hated Christmas and I hate Christmas, and but she was talking about how they have these boxes that they sell for 50 cents that go to help orphans. And she says, these people are spending $200, and then they go, no, I don't want to get the box. Mm-hmm. And she goes, it's Christmas.
Right.
Isn't that
right?
I mean, it's 50 cents, you know, you're spending $200 for clothes. It's just 50 cents. And it was driving her crazy that day because everybody had done that. And then I said, well, I guess I have to pay the 50 cents now.
Right. I mean, I'm sure in her case, she sees the worst of human nature.
That's
right?
What she said.
Yeah. I know that can be really hard. Having worked in retail myself, I completely understand.
Well, it's nice because I have the luxury at my bookstore of, because, you know, I'm old enough that I can do this, and I don't, you know, it's, so if someone comes up in my bookstore and I don't like them, I'll say something like, will you leave if I give you $20? Or someone will come up and they'll say, this is usually Republicans, they'll come up and they'll, oh, I shouldn't have said that, damn. They'll come up and they'll say, this book costs too much. And I go, okay, well, just pay what you want for it then. And they look at me like deer caught in headlights. And they'll say, you mean whatever? What do you mean? I said, just pay what you think it's worth. And they'll go, well, yeah, well, what if I said I wasn't going to pay anything? I said, okay. And one guy did. One guy paid nothing and just walked out with it.
He just walked out with the book. That's pretty wild.
I figure it's just karma, you know?
Now, so I want to challenge you on something, though. You say you don't like Christmas, but, or the holidays, but as a bookstore owner, isn't it a time when you actually make quite a few sales and have people excited to buy presents for their kids? And, like, is that not contagious at all to have that kind of,
it is.
Know?
And, I mean, I'm not a Santa Claus, but I have tons of elves. And the store looks absolutely beautiful. And we're making,
yeah.
We make 10 times as much money as we do during the rest of the year. And people are so happy coming in. But books are a lot different than going to the mall. And, you know, buying people things that they don't need. What better thing could you? And now I'm in this problem because people ask me what I want for Christmas, and all I ever used to say was books.
Yep.
And now I can't say that. So I just tell them to buy me blue cufflinks because they're really small and I don't need them. But I can put them in a box and it gives them, you know, something they can buy me.
Well, what about noise-canceling headphones or something like that?
I already have them. I don't need anything. I don't.
Now, do you do e-books? Do you read e-books?
Yeah, I do, because I've done 160 interviews so far, and rather than carrying the books around, and plus, you know, you can get the definitions of the words, and I can take notes in the corner to ask you questions, and or to remember what questions to ask you.
So you don't have a problem with that?
I don't.
With e-books? Nope.
Well, everyone in my store has a problem with it, and I do have a problem with Amazon, owning Abe, and that's why on our website, what I'll do is describe a book, and I'll say, hey, this is what it costs an Abe. This is what I'll charge you for it. But lucky, you know, I have a whole rare book collection. And, you know, so I just explain this is what it is, and I like the idea of explaining it to someone without having to say octavo or whatever you say.
Well, I have I live in Montclair, New Jersey, and there's a great bookstore here, Wachung Books, owned by Margot Sage L. I don't know if you know Margot. She's lovely. And she was the head of the North Atlantic book, New Atlantic book, whatever that, whatever your organization is, independent bookstores.
Yes.
But she, anyway, but that, I see that what they're doing is what you're talking about, which is really curating. You know, you're not just selling books. You're providing people with all kinds of advice and a way to think about books and reading that's probably different.
It's exactly the opposite of Barnes & Noble. It's very simple.
That's right.
And the other thing that, you know, you can get Amazon recommendations and all that stuff, but when you go, and I have book ladders too, which I've always wanted all my life.
Mm, I love those.
So, and the thing that's bad about it is, like, I could climb up half the book ladder and take one of, I take a book out, and an hour later I realize I'm in exactly the same spot and I haven't moved.
But that's pretty exciting.
It is exciting. And then the other thing is when people come and look at the used book section, they may be looking for one book, but when they look for it, they'll see the book on either side of the book they're looking for, and that book could change their life.
And that's a huge difference. I was just in Ann Patchett's bookstore in
Nashville,
which is wonderful, and it sounds like what you're describing with the ladders and the, you know, and the knowledgeable staff, the people who really care about books. Love books, passionate about books.
I've never hired anyone. People come into the store, and they like it, and they read there, and then they say, "Can I work here?" And I say, "Sure." And that's how that's how it happens. I've never actively attempted put an ad or anything like that. It's just, it just seems to work that way.
That sounds perfect.
Look, this is what happens. I end up talking about myself, and you're supposed to be some, but you have 2 million sold, so what do you really need? You know, you don't need me.
Exactly. Exactly. All we want to do is stimulate some conversation in Philadelphia, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And like I said, you know, we have all these outlets, and your publicist will have this in Dropbox, assuming you want anyone to hear it.
Yeah.
And and I think, and besides, the free library is going to give you a great leg up, and then when you come back in March, I think so many people will know about it. And, I mean, you know, you have the book club questions in there, which sometimes I get a little iffy about, but they're good questions.
Well, those are pretty good questions. But, again, I think if people go to my website and look at those questions, they're going to see the questions that were actually crowdsourced, you know, that people really, the ones that people really do ask over and over again.
Yeah, it's funny because it's a book that, well, and again, without giving anything away... And we talked about this last week when we were talking about the best books of 2014. A lot of people come in the bookstore and they say, "I want a book with a happy ending." And I don't really like books with happy endings. And your book has an ending that, as I said, is kind of like a beginning in so many ways. And those are the kinds I like, where it leaves you wondering. You
yeah,
know,
that's
gonna...
definitely how I see it, that it's a beginning. You know, you and I talked about the last line before we opened this conversation, and I would just tell readers that that line actually appears much earlier in the book when Vivian meets Molly for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
So it's echoed in the ending, and it, I think it portends a journey ahead.
It's true, and it's also interesting the way, and you do this, and other writers haven't done this. I've never actually... Because it kind of reminds me of my life, where Vivian says, "Yeah, after my husband died, pretty much nothing happened. Nothing happened the rest of my life." And I thought, you know, that's so many people. That's true.
But this is something I kept hearing from train writers. That basic. Well, here's this amazing thing. Okay, there's this great book that I'm obsessed with that you've probably never heard of. I discovered it in the Pioneer Museum in North Dakota, okay? And it's called Rachel Kaloff, A Jewish Homesteader on the Prairie. That is the title of this book. How could you not want to read that book? So I buy the book, and I'm reading it, and I'm obsessed with it. It's, she's having, first of all, she's not only Jewish on the prairie, she is kosher. She's starving to death in the blizzard because she won't eat certain foods at certain times with her whole family. And it's pretty insane. They live in a sod hut. They're blizzards. The whole thing, they're locusts. It's like Laura Ingalls Wilder on steroids. It's so horrifying. And then, right toward the end of the book, they basically, like, walk 10 miles, and they're in civilization with running water and lights and a clapboard house. And she lives the rest of her life in this little town with, like, Main Street. It's so disorienting. It reminds me of that M. Night Shyamalan movie, The Village, which you watch this whole movie. I'm giving it away. This is a spoiler alert. You watch this whole movie, and it's set in, like, the, you know, 18th century or something, and it's witches, and it's weird stuff happening, and then they pan back at the very end, and it's right beside a highway. So I was inspired by that woman's story, realizing that, you know, this dramatic stuff happened. That's the story. The rest of her life is an ordinary life.
My house was built in 1775, and M. Night Shyamalan had his production designer fly in a helicopter around Philadelphia until he found a circular field that was as close as he could get to the city. And they wanted to use my house as the site for the village.
Oh, you're kidding.
and then they didn't, but they would have.
That is funny. That is really funny. I'll just tell you one other thing that I've never really talked about. So you know how toward the end of the book this surprising thing happens and then it just ends?
Yes.
Vivian's story just ends.
Yes.
I was inspired by Psycho.
Oh.
I saw that movie a few times, and I loved how it happens differently, but of course. But 20 minutes into the film, you think, what's going to happen now? The main character's gone. I mean, that doesn't exactly happen in my book. But it was something about that immediate just drop that I thought, if Alfred Hitchcock can get away with it, I can get away with it too.
Well, it's funny because my mother, who's 92 and who's Jewish and lived in Charleston, West Virginia, when she was like, and she can't figure out why was she, I said, why were there Jewish people in Charleston, West Virginia in the 1920s? And she goes, I don't know. And so I've never really figured it out. But she'll say things to me. She's kind of mean. She'll say things to me like, you look like Anthony Perkins, but only in Psycho.
You know what? Your voice sounds like you look like Anthony Perkins.
Oh, jeez.
I don't know why that is.
But sometimes she'll say that I look like Hervé Villechaize from Fantasy Island, too.
Well, I'm not getting that vibe at all, I must say.
Well, you'll meet me and you will find out.
Exactly.
You look lovely in your pictures.
Well, thanks. I'm sure that it was all the lighting. All about the lighting.
Well, we've been talking, for 52 minutes, which means that they're going to get really mad at me. But anyway, this was so much fun. This was so much fun.
That was great. Thank you so much for having me on, and I cannot wait to visit your bookstore.
And we can't wait either, and I'll have my people call your people.
Okay. That sounds great.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you again so much.
That was Christina Baker Klein talking about The Orphan Train, and I can now announce that she will be appearing at our bookstore sometime in March for a book signing, and we'll have a great time. We'll have food, we'll have drinks, we'll have... announced it everywhere so you'll know that it's coming. And I'll get with her publicist today, Caitlin, and we'll try and work it all out. Anyway, so we got some, you know, Rebecca always gets these people, and I don't know how she does it. And this was one of them. I mean, this is one hell of a book, and it's kicking butt. And she's all over the place. I mean, and there's 2 million in print, and there's going to be a lot more. So upcoming, we have S.M. Holes and Eric Metaxas. It's Metaxas. They're going to discuss their latest works, Black River and Miracles. Both of them are great books. But for a complete schedule, you can always go to our website, wellingtonscrubbooks.com, or Facebook, or YouTube, or any number of social media outlets, some of which I don't even know what they are. So thanks, as always, for joining us. This was a great interview, and they may cut it so you may not hear part of it, but... hopefully, you'll get the gist of it. In any event, we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.